Welcome to the Eye Candy Duo podcast with me, Naomi Williams, a 30-something parent of none, baffled by how much is undiscussed in the world of pregnancy and parenthood. I'll be asking the questions you want the answers to on this podcast, which is brought to you by Eye Candy World, makers of beautifully British pushchairs for parents across the globe. We're delighted to be joined on the Eye Candy Duo podcast by Lisa Dewan, Irish stage, film and television actress, director and writer known for her performances and adaptions of the work of Samuel Beckett, as well as roles in Netflix Top Boy and BBC One's Bloodlands. After recently announcing the news of her pregnancy, we caught up with Lisa to chat to her about becoming a mother and preparing to raise a daughter, as well as getting ready to return to the stage in a post-lockdown world. Hi, Lisa. Thank you so much for being on the Eye Candy Duo podcast. It's wonderful to have you on. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you for having me. Yes, no, I'm in great spirits. Beautiful sunny day, and I'm just back from my 20-week scan, and she's doing great, and it's all very exciting.
Oh, fantastic. 20 weeks, and she's cooking along a treat. Brilliant stuff. Well, look, congratulations on the wonderful news, and that you're having a girl as well. That's brilliant.
I know. It feels very special. So it's exciting times ahead, and a lot of work for all of us to do to make this world a lot more safer and palatable for our young girls.
Absolutely. Yeah, she's coming in to an interesting time. Do you know? I mean, Obviously, I think is your due date sort of a latter part of this year, isn't it? So hopefully she'll be born into some sense of normalcy. But it's been a radical year, actually, with a lot of, social unrest and like sort of protests and things like that. It's a lot of voices that have been heard over a very kind of, isolated, quiet time. So you're quite right that it's going to be an interesting time to bring up a young lady into this kind of crazy new world. I mean, actually, when you announced it on Instagram, you were kind of showing off a lot of parenting books as well, the kind of more classic ways of preparing for baby. I mean, how are you getting on? How are you ploughing through them?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure any mother out there will understand when I say every time I open a book, I fall asleep. you're so busy, working and juggling your career and preparing a house for this little tornado that's going to come in, that when it comes to sitting down and actually studying how to actually do this, I nod off very quickly. So I think my limit's about 5 pages. So it's slow, but what's amazing, and I don't know if you've found this, you would think, thousands of years into society and we're already like grossly overpopulated, I cannot get over the joy and excitement and buzz around a new baby announcement. I don't think I've ever experience so much goodwill and like genuine excitement from people about another little being coming into this world. It just goes to show that there's room for another small one always. And I just love the fact that it hasn't been met with any cynicism or boredom. If it has, I certainly haven't noticed. Maybe it's my rose-tinted glasses, but I cannot get over how much goodwill and how it just cheers everybody up with the thought of a new baby. I'm really amazed.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's your kind of first, sort of flushings within, your pregnancy, is that you're just being so warmly received by everybody.
Yeah. Shocked, probably, knowing it's me.
Like that. We didn't think it was going to happen.
Exactly.
they're kind of just going, she'll be fine. Like, no, I mean, I think, I wonder if it's a, you know, it'd be interesting actually if you talk to other mothers, you know, if it's maybe a reflection of the times as well, as much as that, you know, obviously everybody loves a new baby, like, you know, and I think, I know what you're saying, kind of on a kind of global perspective, you think, God, you know, actually, I can understand your sort of errs on, you know, this kind of big round of like congratulations and things like that, of absolute sincere, like, this is fantastic news. But I wonder if it's slightly changed because of the environment that we're in, that actually throughout this sort of dread, like this, you know, weird, what is it, sort of 12, 13 months that we've been in, that people are just like, that's fantastic. Like, this just, you know, the new hope of life after this horrendous pandemic. I wonder if it's more so, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I do remember years ago, my mum, who's a nurse, saying to me that the announcement of a baby always brings joy into home, no matter what the circumstances are. And I've only remembered her saying that to me as I've experienced that very joy myself. So, I don't know. Obviously, any bit of good news after the year we've had is even more welcome. But I still think that there is always that bizarre naivety and excitement about life. I guess that is the essence of what humanity is all about.
I mean, how has lockdown been for you?
You know what? I feel almost guilty saying this, because I have had the happiest time of my life. COVID is without a doubt the best thing that ever happened to me. I was on a plane about to go to America, where I live half my life. I teach in Princeton, and I'm a US resident. And so I lived my life between New York and London, to a chaotic degree, often flying over once a week. And I had decided that I would go and spend COVID, which we thought would just be a matter of months max, in New York. And I was all packed up, and it was the 15th of March, and it was the last day you could fly before the travel ban. And it was chaotic at Heathrow, and I packed up my beautiful flat and brought all my clothes, and I was sitting on the plane when the most ginormous instinct told me to get off the plane. And I said to the lady, can I take my bags off the flight? And she said, well, we're just about to push back. You need to decide now. And I said, can you give me 1 minute? And my mind went at 100 miles an hour. And she came back and she said, what do you want to do, Mr. Warren? And I nodded at her and I said, yes, please take off my bags. And I had to wait until someone got me while the doors closed and that plane left for New York. And I, through a kind of haze, a fog, found myself back, landing myself again, having to go through immigration and taking a taxi home and ringing a friend of mine, Paul, on the way back, who had very kindly organized a car for me from JFK out to the Hamptons, where I was going to be going. And I said, cancel the car, I'm on my way back to Hampstead, and would you like some stew? And an overstocked fridge like everybody else at the time. And Paul came round and we started going running together. And as the world retreated into the weirdest contraction in our tiny lives, into our little cubes, and everything closing and toilet paper disappearing from shelves, and people all of a sudden forgetting they were allergic to gluten with the amount of bread that was being sold and made, we clung to each other and went running every day, just as friends. And then he went off to work at the Nightingale Hospital. He was got a phone call when he was around for dinner one evening. Could he build a hospital in 10 days? And he's that kind of brain who's able to organize things like that. And I said, so what are you going to do for food? And so, without remembering that I couldn't actually cook, I offered to cook for him every day. And so I learned how to cook, in COVID, I was testing Amazon's abilities by ordering a cello, which arrived. And then I found a teacher who was willing to teach me Bach's cello concerto over Zoom, because I didn't want to do anything boring like scales or anything. And she agreed. And so I started learning the cello, and I was cooking, and I was putting up poems. You know, as an artist, you don't know what to do, but to try and puncture this atmosphere of fear and terror with beauty and humanity and poetry. And so I did these poetry readings every day. And it was in that climate of clinging on to life, really, and the best of life, that Paul and I fell in love. And now we're having a little baby. And that wouldn't have been possible for someone like me who just got on a plane every week, had it not been for COVID.
Oh, my God. You should make that a movie. That just held me so captivated. Do you know, it's funny, isn't it? Like, that instinct that you had on that plane, you know, it's almost like your fate was tethering you back, almost. It's always, I mean, I don't know if, you know, believing in fate and all that kind of stuff, but it does seem so, that's incredible. So that, yeah, I could kind of see exactly what you mean by COVID's just given you this other, it was almost kind of like a different sense of life. Like you say, you're traveling every week, you know, and having such a transatlantic life. Yeah, you know, it must be very difficult to kind of, for you personally, to be able to kind of have these relationships, have, you know, flourish and give it time to grow into something, you know, with potentially. That's incredible.
Well, you know, I was so lucky to be a professor in Princeton or in Columbia, where I was teaching before that. And then also so lucky to be in a Netflix series or a BBC series or tour the world with a one-woman play. You know, you just felt like you had to take those opportunities. But there was, you know, a cost to that. And the cost of that was my personal social life. So while I was kind of following my dreams, and I was shooting for 2 years, I was shooting Top Boy Monday to Friday. And then Friday night or Saturday morning, I would get on a plane to New York, write my lecture on the plane, and then land, sleep off a bit of jet lag, and go in and give a 3-hour seminar on the Monday, and then get on a plane that night and fly back to London to be on set for Tuesday morning.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, I felt extremely blessed, but we took so much of that for granted. I would jump on a plane. Like, I flew to Adelaide in Australia and to New Zealand from London just for 4 or 5 days for a festival, and then come back again. Or I would do crazy things, like I was performing in Los Angeles, and I had to give a performance in Dublin, and I flew back for one night on my one night off on this tour of the Beckett trilogy in Los Angeles to do one performance in Dublin, to get back on a plane again and carry on performing in LA. I would do crazy things.
I was
going
to say, like, you're a lunatic. Also, you're a lunatic with some incredible air miles, but... My goodness. But yeah, you're right. I mean, when you solely focus, you know, and quite rightly, especially within the arts world, it's incredibly, it's very competitive, and you really have to make a mark, and you have to kind of really, you know, it's not just a job. It's kind of intrinsic as part of your DNA to really kind of throw yourself into it. But like you say, it comes at a sacrifice. You know, if you want to do well in one area, you know, yeah, like you say, your personal life, yeah, undoubtedly would have suffered, because, I mean, by the sounds of it, you weren't in one place longer than, you know, a matter of a few days.
No, and that becomes addictive, you know, moving and packing. And and so it took a global pandemic to bring me to a standstill and to allow myself that kind of quiet, soft space to not only fall in love with Paul, but to fall in love with my own life. And that was a lovely lesson in COVID. I realized that there's an awful lot of things I have that I don't need. And I get great joy out of nature and getting up early in the morning and getting on Hampstead Heath and seeing nature's progression and changes and peaks and flows. I really do. I know I sound like a nerd. And I also get huge pleasure out of literature and poetry. And I love kind of sucking the marrow out of life with very simple things. You know, for years, I chased the kind of the bright lights of theater. And it's good to realize that I can find real joy and happiness in very simple things. And that's definitely a quality I think was handed on from my family. I grew up in the country in Ireland, and my parents, you know, they never spend a penny on themselves. And, you know, just have a very kind of close connection to nature. And I would love to be able to pass that on to my little girl. Because I think particularly we've noticed, as everyone's just plugged into screens, how TikTok and Facebook and Instagram just selling stuff to you nonstop, selling bad narratives for a start about what beauty is, about what happiness is, what it is and isn't, and what fame is. And an awful lot of all of that is very toxic. And I would love to be able to give my daughter some more kind of wholesome grounding in that regard.
Mm. It's so true, actually, because I was actually having a joke the other day with I was on a meeting, and we were actually commenting on our kind of like how conversation has changed, but it's actually quite endearing how it's changed. So, you know, before you might be talking about all these kind of exploits that you've been getting up to, like, oh, look how busy I am. Look, this is what I've been doing. I've been going to this, that, and the other. But instead we had this kind of 5-minute conversation about how she'd gone to a garden centre and she bought a flower pot and what she was planning to grow in her garden. And we were kind of giggling like, God, what's happened to us? But it was actually kind of really lovely to stop and actually talk about things like that. It's actually those lovely, quiet moments, because that's, you know, like you say, I mean, there's dreadful things about COVID. Let's not paint it in a different way. But the footnote has definitely been this kind of this peace and time alone at home, and actually just stopping and observing more, you know, without being distracted so much. I mean, you know, it has had that lovely blessing. You know, there we can have, just have this lovely conversations with people about, oh, what are you growing? Oh, how's your basil coming on? You know, but it's actually kind of lovely to have that sort of thing going on. But as the world, I mean, the world is beginning to stir from this kind of deep slumber. And with that, of course, comes, you know, thankfully, that the arts is slowly coming back to life, you know, with the theatre, which is obviously a huge part of what you do. You mentioned actually previously when you're doing all these incredible flights across the world with, you know, your Sam Beckett trilogy and things like that. You know, the stage is a huge part of you. I mean, obviously, you've had this lovely kind of year and, you know, you found love, you're having a baby. I mean, how are you feeling about, you know, the world reawakening and going back to the stage and back to filming?
Well, funnily enough, I was pretty lucky. I had just finished a TV series a few days before lockdown, the first lockdown. And I had to continue on with post-production, albeit very remotely in a new weird way that I'd never worked before. But one of the best things about COVID, another amazing thing, particularly professionally, is that you've had to throw convention out of the window. Oh, this is not how we do things. You know what? In order to do anything or make anything, and people were running out of content, they had to throw convention out of the window. And there's no word that depresses me more than conventional. So I was really thrilled about that. And people who would normally say no to ideas were saying yes to ideas because they had no ideas. and so I was, you know, I made a big audiobook. I was doing lots of different events. I was doing lots of writing. And then I finished the TV series remotely, doing post-production on that. And then there's been a passion project of mine, a play that was written for me that I always felt would work very well for camera. And I love that world in between theatre and camera. I don't necessarily like capturing theatre for television or screen. I prefer it to have its own medium. So you perform especially for the camera. You might think of films like Lars von Trier, Dogville, or Vanya on 42nd Street, or Ingmar Bergman's After the Rehearsal. These are the sort of movies that I grew up with and I find very inspiring. And so Tim Davie was just taking over the BBC, and 3 days before he actually took up the post, I said, I have to meet you. And I pitched him the idea, and fair play to him, he commissioned it. And so I made a film of Antigone in lockdown, which is available on BBC iPlayer, called Pale Sister. It was a play that was written for me by the Irish novelist Colm Toibín. And it, for me, having been exposed to Beckett for so long, it means that you don't play stories. Like, there's no narratives in Beckett. You're totally liberated from that. You play kind of creatures, beings, slices of the whole consciousness. And so when I went back to playing all the usual narratives that women are made to perform, various versions of the bitch, the bimbo, or the psycho, I thought there's something deeply wrong here. And I really feel that that's where the roots of misogyny come from, are in our earliest narratives. The idea of Antigone in the Greeks being this troublesome, mouthy upstart who challenges the patriarchy, challenges a tyrant, and is therefore deemed to be threatening to civilization and is sentenced to death. Then there's Medea, the immigrant mother who will kill your children. And, you know, she's created as this sort of emblem, a parable, something to be feared and rejected. I mean, look what's happened to Meghan Markle, the idea of the immigrant mother. Read the Daily Mail on any given day. They're still spouting off that. And then Medusa, this intelligent woman. Well, it was during the Trump campaign that I saw so many versions of Medusa's head used by the Trump campaign with Hillary Clinton's face on it, that I realized that our ancient narratives are the ones that are working most today. And that even the Trump campaign knew that, knowing that their supporters, let's say, wouldn't have a deep grounding in ancient Greek literature, they still had a transgenerational bias or biases. But it was very easy to trigger an ancient misogyny by using those ancient emblems. And so I thought, if I'm going to contribute anything to this, and it was during the time of hashtag Me Too and all of this, and I just thought, I don't need to throw my name into the fire there. Of course, I've got tons of Me Too stories. Who hasn't? But I didn't think I was serving anybody, least of all myself, by that action. And I really admire the women who did stand up and do that. But mine, I realized, was a different path. I wanted to go deeper and to go deeper and to contribute to what I consider to be the biggest problem are the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves. And I wanted to give my nieces and my daughter, who was not really even an idea at the time, but the next generation of women, something more than just a hashtag. I wanted them to have role models where you can speak truth to the how to power and be articulate and be sane and be rational and, you know what, be right. And I just wanted to contribute something there to those narratives because, you know, as an actress, my job is to serve narratives, and I'm sick and tired of serving these patriarchal narratives without doing something or taking an action myself. And Beckett gave me the confidence and the clarity to do that. Beckett, I would say, introduced me to myself. So that was a real passion project. And I feel very grateful that I was able to do that this year as well. And I was very grateful that COVID meant that people, you know, they're running out of content. And what they would have probably said in the past to me is, oh, that's not what we do. Well, you know what? Now, this year, they do things like that. And so it was perfect environment. And we shot it at Riverside Studio, all socially distant. I produced it myself. I performed in it, obviously, and edited it and worked with Trevor Nunn, who was extraordinary. You know, he could have just come in as real director and had his own vision. And I asked him for help. I asked him to come on board. And I said, on one condition, that we do this together, because I have a vision that I really need to pay homage to, and I really need it to be my vision. And fair play to him. You know, he's at a kind of stage in his career where he is willing to nourish and let the next generation express themselves, and at least in this project he did. And we're now commencing rehearsals again on Samuel Beckett's Happy Days, where it's one woman buried up to her waist, which is perfect for a pregnant actress. And we will open to a live theatre audience on June the 11th. And that's very exciting. To think that my daughter's first appearance will be in the womb on stage with me.
Oh, that's amazing.
And in between, I've been filming Top Boy for Netflix. And, you know, you get tested 2-3 times a week. And they've been following all the COVID protocols. But since we've been filming since November, and it's been going very well.
That's incredible. So actually, you've been enormously busy by the sounds of it throughout this whole process. And I have to say, I love what you are doing and what you have done with the story of Antigone. I actually, when I was probably about 18, I found it, probably you're well aware of this, but a book by Elizabeth Wurtzel called Bitch. And it very much kind of covers through the same sort of things that you just covered, where there's like Samson and Delilah. It's like the depictions of women through sort of time, space, and through, you know, via different countries and things like that. And it's a real teller of how at that given time, in that space, in that place, of how women are really sort of seen through various different sort of scenarios. And, you know, like you're saying about Hillary Clinton and things like that, it's crazy to think in this day, in this time, that we still, you know, we still speak through this sort of ancient view of women still.
But it's getting worse. That's the thing. We might think that women are being liberated. It's getting worse. The anger is worse. As more women, because of education and employment law, really, are taking positions that would have been occupied by men only. And they're forcing men to relinquish power and step aside from the mediocrity that they have been holding guard. And it's threatening. And the result of that threat is a kind of palpable anger. And we need to be careful. We need to be careful of men like Jordan Peterson, who was igniting a real rage among young men a few years ago. Thankfully, he seems to have fallen on his own sword. And, as Russia recovering from an opioid addiction. But it's we have to be careful. You know, if a man who can boast about grabbing women by the pussy can take the most powerful position in the world, we need to be really careful. The atmosphere is not good.
Very much so. I mean, you've recently, or should I say, I've just been aware of your work with Solace, you know, the women's aid charity as well. Has this been kind of a whole consciousness of, you know, really trying to support women and children in a kind of very direct way? Obviously, the particular women's aid charity, Solace, works within London, and offers free advice and support to women and children. Is that kind of important work for you, especially now that you're pregnant?
Well, it's vital. You know, the first thing you kind of think about everyone being imprisoned in their homes. I was very lucky. I was in my own home, in a safe home, in a beautiful home. And it just makes you think immediately of the women where home is hell. And so often, you know, children are born into those prisons almost of abuse. And just the rates shot up of violence towards women. The figures were just absolutely shocking. To think at least 3 women are killed a week in England is just terrifying. And, you know, for any woman listening here, one in 3 of us will be in a violent relationship, abusive relationship, and 1 in 5 of us will have been raped.
It's a terrifying landscape, I have to say. I mean, I don't know if it's because of COVID or, you know, why, but I think this time has really, I mean, for me personally, made me really look at the work of different charities, and specifically, you know, very much of what Solace are doing. We've recently spoken on the podcast to Project Mama, which is a charity based in Bristol that really kind of sort of similar dynamic, but specifically work with women that are like refugees or immigrants or, you know, victims of sex trafficking within the UK, and kind of building relationships and bonds and support for them. And it's incredible. I mean, that there are a number of kind of amazing people doing amazing things out there, but also women helping women, which I think is such an integral thing, especially in the space of pregnancy and motherhood. You know, it's very much kind of reflects back to.
And you know what? That's probably the least developed tool that we have. And I find that to be the most troubling aspect of all of this, is that we have internalized centuries of misogynistic messaging. And what the Greeks were particularly good at, and they do it in Antigone in particular, is divide and rule, is set, you know, one woman against one another. The good girl who acquiesces gets to live, and the bad girl whose mouth the and speaks up dies. And we have played women off each other. We do it in the world of beauty all the time. And compare and despair. Look, we're doing it right now with Meghan and Kate, and that's being played out in the public atmosphere. It's disgusting. And I find it the most troubling thing at all of internalized misogyny. And we do need to band together and gather our sisters together and help each other move forward. And because if we don't do it together, we won't make any progress at all. And I think we need to be very careful about reclaiming the word woman and womanhood. And I don't think we should have any shame about that at all. And I think we need to support one another more, and now more than ever.
No, absolutely. And actually a lot of the podcasts that we've done, that is such a sort of strong message from a number of people I've spoken to, because of that, the space that it does, you know, there is that kind of the gap of that not really existing, or it not really having enough airtime, you know, and talked about sort of unapologetically as well. I mean, you're about to have a daughter. So, I mean, if you were going to impart, as we're actually sadly coming up to our 3-minute mark, Lisa, of what time we have left. So as a sort of parting question, what do you, if you were going to give your daughter a kind of a few pearls of wisdom, a few kind of points of advice, what do you think it would be as she's growing up to be a woman in this world?
I think kindness is the most precious thing you can foster. I think even as you grow and become defiant and strong, you should always look for the opportunities to be kind. I think it's great to be, as I have been, feisty and defiant. But I think kindness is often far more powerful and long-lasting. I think that it's okay to be afraid. I think it's okay to feel your fear. There's fear everywhere, and I think that's a normal part of life. courage is when you feel the fear and go on regardless. It doesn't mean that you're born with some sort of privilege that you are without fear. It means you have the fear and you go on regardless. And I think that's what courage is. And I think courage is a muscle that you have to exercise. And the only way to exercise it is by confronting your fears. And they would be the main things. And I would just encourage her to fearlessly go after with an excitement and an enthusiasm every desire she has, as long as it's healthy desire, real desire, and go after whatever she wants to do in life. And don't let the critics in her head hold her back.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'll take that advice as well. But Lisa, I could talk to you all day, but sadly Zoom is not going to allow us. So look, thank you so much for joining us, and it's been really fascinating to have a chat with you today, and I thank you so much for your time, and all the best with your new arrival.
Thank you, I really appreciate it. It was a great chat, and thank you very much. And I really love eye candy, so it's amazing to be able to work closely with them now, and I feel like it's a great start for my young little one, and to be snuggled up so safely.
Thank you so much. Well, we have less than a minute to go, so thank you so much, Lisa. It's been a pleasure, and take care. To find out more information about the topics covered in today's podcast, head to the iCandy blog page on www.icandyworld.com/blog. You can also catch up on season one, featuring thought-provoking and engaging interviews from a mix of industry leaders, experts, celebrity parents, and healthcare specialists, all via your preferred podcast provider. If you enjoyed today's episode, then don't forget to leave a review and hit like and subscribe to ensure you never miss an episode. iCandy is a proud supporter of Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital charity. Every day brings new challenges at GOSH, and this extraordinary hospital depends on charitable support to give seriously ill children the best chance to fulfil their potential. A donation from as little as £10 could pay for a genetic test that will help diagnose sick children, whilst only £50 could cover the cost of one night stay for parents in GOSH's family accommodation. Every little bit helps support both children and parents alike in making a challenging time as comfortable as possible. If you would like to make a donation, please head to discover.icandyworld.com/gosh.